Air Force police cars with flashing lights turned off the tarmac at Kelly Air Force Base, southwest of downtown San Antonio. It wound its way carefully across Interstate 410 and into the neighboring Lackland Air Force Base's Medina Annex, slowly passing a neighborhood made up of new ranch homes. At the center of the convoy, an ungainly vehicle called a straddle carrier, whose driver sat in a cab high above the roadway, held precious cargo slung between its four-wheeled legs. The vehicle resembled a giant spider protecting its eggs. The convoy drove into Site King, a secret area in Medina, where about 100 humpbacked rectangular bunkers made of fortified steel and concrete, known as igloos, each roughly the size of four 2-car garages, served as one of the country's largest nuclear weapons installations. The security was required because the convoy was transporting the explosive mechanisms of partially dismantled Mark 7 nuclear warheads, hundreds of which were being taken out of service. Technicians had removed the pits of radioactive fissile material from these warheads, leaving behind a round metallic shell of TNT-based baryton and cyclotol explosives, natural uranium, a hard, dense element found in minute quantities in most rocks and soil, and depleted uranium, a widely used metal left over when natural uranium is chemically enriched to make nuclear fuel. These spheres, each roughly the size of a beach ball, were studded with detonators that, if a bomb were fully armed and triggered, would initiate a nuclear explosion up to four times more powerful than the one that had destroyed Hiroshima 18 years earlier. Without the fissile material, these warheads wouldn't do anything like that, but even so, the explosives left behind would pack a mighty punch if they were ignited. On this day, at Igloo 572, the spheres, each weighing hundreds of pounds, were loaded onto a steel pallet, carefully placed on a hydraulic lift, moved past the pair of 10-foot-tall, 2,000-pound steel doors, and hauled into the dim interior. The igloo was nearly full of the spheres, 209 of them. Stacked along the floor and divided by a narrow aisle down the center, they were, in essence, one gigantic bomb. Civilian contractors Louis Ellinger Sr. and Floyd Lutz were laying a pallet into place. It was difficult work. Another contractor, Hillary Hutzer, was standing just outside the door, logging numbers from the remaining warheads. At 10:24 a.m., he was startled by a sudden loud crack coming from the igloo, and then saw Lutz and Ellinger heading toward him. He ran. Life was good for the kids who lived in Lackland's Medina Annex in the early 60s. Carefree is the word many of them use now to recall those days, even though many of their parents were deeply engaged in the struggles of the Cold War. In the mornings, Blue Air Force buses took the kids to Lackland Elementary School. In the afternoons, the same buses brought them back to their neat homes and manicured lawns. After school, they would take off on bikes or roller skate to the pool or get hot dogs and popsicles at Lackland's Golf Club snack bar. Because the community was integrated, like all military bases, black and white kids played together in a way that was uncommon. On trips into San Antonio, the kids would gawk at whites-only signs posted above public drinking fountains. Officers' wives attended white-glove afternoon teas and called the kids to weekday supper at 5 o'clock sharp. At sunset, the soulful notes of taps brought the day to a close. "Such a sheltered environment," said Claudia Petrosky, now 67, who grew up there. "Parents didn't worry if we were out riding bikes. Everybody knew everybody. Everyone else's mom was looking out for you." Most of the kids growing up at Lackland were insulated, not just from the outside world, but also from the base's grim purpose, preparing to fight a civilization-ending nuclear war with the Soviet Union. Many of them knew that Site King had something to do with nuclear weapons. After all, the droop-winged B-52s that carried thermonuclear bombs on their global readiness missions landed nearby for servicing, and the weapons designed to kill millions of people came in for regular refurbishment at Medina. But the business of fighting a nuclear war was something adults generally didn't talk to them about. Site King's 88 acres were surrounded by three concentric rings of chain-link fence topped with barbed wire, and canine units and armed guards patrolled the grounds. For some Air Force kids, that all seemed to promise high adventure, reachable by way of a hard hike through tangled underbrush and across Medina Creek. The complex exerted an irresistible pull on young Bill McRaven, who lived at 212 Baseview Drive. One day he carried his Roy Rogers cap gun on a mission with his buddies to climb over the first fence around the property, foretelling the commando operations he would later lead as a legendary Navy SEAL commander. The authorities stopped the kids before they got to the second fence, aborting their mission. Others, mindful of the barbed wire topping the fences, went low. "We'd just go under the fence," recalled Floyd Smith, who also grew up on the base at the time, but they never made it all the way into Site King's center. Over the span of almost six decades, memories have faltered and blurred, and the question of why one of the warhead assemblies in the Igloo 572 sparked off remains frustratingly unanswered. It seems likely that a detonator was accidentally bumped and then ignited, quickly setting fire to the sphere of highly explosive TNT and uranium metal. That's how the device was supposed to work, after all, just not inside a storage igloo. "There's no direct answer to what caused it that we know of," insists Floyd Lutz, who is 80 and owns a water treatment business in San Antonio. "When the igloo was fixing to ignite, we were inside setting down those units. As soon as that loud crack sounded, he and Ellinger scampered through the open doorway amid dust and smoke. The fire started, so we hauled ass," Lutz explained. "They sprinted past Huser, yelling as they went." "They didn't have to tell me to run," said Huser. "They went one way. I went the other, down Perimeter Road. I guess it had rained the day before, and I bogged down in a ditch and fell. Got back up, turned around and looked, and there was smoke coming off of the igloo's vent. I was going to go to the next set of igloos to set off an alarm. I got about halfway, and the whole thing blew up." Huser, who died this past August, weeks after I last spoke to him, paused and rested his large hands on the carefully folded newspaper clippings and faded photographs spread out on the kitchen table of his modest one-story house near Bunko in a gently rolling scrubland between San Antonio and Austin. Behind his rimless glasses, he had a thousand-yard stare that took him back more than half a century. "I didn't think I was going to make it to the next row of igloos," he said softly. Within a minute, the fire that had started with one sphere ignited all 209 spheres in the igloo, setting off a tremendous detonation. The entire steel and concrete igloo and its contents, the hydraulic Yale lift, the steel pallets, and the one-ton steel doors all went airborne, as did the dirt and layers of rock that lay as far down as 25 feet beneath the surface. Nothing was left but an empty crater more than half a football field wide. Much of the uranium and depleted uranium metal were vaporized into the towering cloud of dust and debris that rose 1,000 feet. As Ellinger and Lutz ran, the pressure wave struck, throwing them down the road. They got up, started sprinting again, and made it about 100 yards from the igloo before Ellinger leaped into a culvert where he tried to dodge debris. A chunk of concrete smashed into his thigh, leaving a knot that he says is still there. "We were lucky enough not to be blowed to pieces," Lutz said. "The higher-ups thought we were all goners. Our boss told them, those guys are probably no longer there." Huser, stunned by the concussive blast that had ruptured his left eardrum, felt time stretch into slow motion. He had a terrifying moment when he realized that the large chunks of steel, concrete, and rock that had gone airborne were just as quickly going to come back down. "I stood there for what seemed like 5 minutes looking in the air to see if I could dodge all that stuff, and I finally decided I couldn't, and the biggest thing I could find was a little old bush." He dove under it and curled himself into the fetal position, his arms clutched tightly over his head as chunks of metal and concrete crashed around him. When it was over, Huser unwound himself, got up, dusted himself off, and looked around. A lethal-sized block of concrete had landed a few feet away. The chain-link fences that enclosed the field of igloos had been blown over by the force of the blast. An old school bus the men had used to travel to and from the main gate had been thrown over on its side and its windows smashed out. Eyeing the wreckage, Huser staggered on shaking legs to the concrete pad at the doorway of a nearby igloo and sat down, wondering what had become of Ellinger and Lutz. Pretty soon, their boss arrived in a vehicle. "I told him the other two guys run off, and he took off without saying anything," Huser remembered. After a while, an ambulance showed up, and an attendant opened the rear door. Ellinger and Lutz were inside. The blast also shook Blackland Elementary School, where kids on the playground saw a cloud of smoke and debris rising over Medina Annex. "We thought World War III had started," said Bill Manro, then a seventh grader. "We were all scared shitless." Sirens were going off, and windows were broken in the Medina housing complex, and residents were rushing into the street to see what was going on. Many of the adults were terrified that a lethal dose of radiation had been released. It had been only a year, after all, since the United States had halted almost two decades of above-ground nuclear testing, which had showered Americans and others with radioactive fallout. People fled the scene in panic, the San Antonio Light reported later that day. Though there was no official evacuation, the roads around the base were jammed bumper to bumper. The damage was hardly limited to the base. A dozen miles across the city, residents on San Antonio's north side reported dishes being thrown from shelves and wall decorations dashed to the floor. The plate glass window fronting the Continental bus station on Broadway, about 13 miles from Lackland, was blown in. Elsewhere, according to the Light, a parrot in a birdcage was knocked to the floor but emerged unhurt. A woman named Dora Aguilar was on the phone about a mile from the blast. "I was talking and the explosion simply blew the phone out of my hand," she told the Associated Press. All over the city, the blast drew people out into the streets to gape at what they later swore was a mushroom-shaped cloud with a cap that was miles wide. Photographs taken that day don't show a mushroom-shaped cloud. When the explosion happened, Hillary Husser's wife, Mary, had just arrived at the Model Market on Vance Jackson Road, 11 miles from the blast. The store's plate glass window had bulged in from the pressure wave, but hadn't broken. She then went to another store where the TV was reporting that there had been an explosion at Medina Annex. Shocked, Mary picked up a bottle of liquor on the way home so that she and Hillary could celebrate what she hoped had been his narrow escape. Given that the blast occurred at a nuclear weapons facility inside of a major American city at a time when the country was obsessed with civil defense, the folks at Lackland might have expected a fast and efficient government response. If they did, they were surely disappointed. The phone lines at Lackland Air Force Base quickly jammed by panicked callers, which meant the authorities couldn't get through. So the Texas Department of Public Safety's Communications Center in Austin assumed the role of coordinating much of the response as best it could from nearly 100 miles away. There was a tremendous amount of confusion. Local Civil Defense Director Martin Esther told reporters that the blast severely shook up the town, figuratively speaking, resulting in a flood of pretty weird tales and utterly ridiculous rumors. One report received by the DPS Center from its district headquarters said that only chemical explosives were involved. Then came a more alarming and erroneous message. Enriched uranium-235 had been stored in the igloo. Another message, hardly reassuring, said that normal uranium was involved and that it might have been carried downwind. A radio station reported that it was probable that a nuclear reactor had blown up. Some people thought that the United States and Soviet Union had finally gone to war. The state's Division of Occupational Health and Radiation Control in Austin later complained that there was little or no authoritative information available to the division the entire day. The division dispatched staff members from Austin to collect soil and vegetation samples to test for radiation. Because the car didn't have a two-way radio, they drove south, unaware of what they were getting into. For most of the day, officials had no way of knowing whether or not there was danger to the surrounding population or if assistance was needed on the base itself, the Disaster Research Center at Ohio State University later observed. Telephone problems also plagued San Antonio Health Department, which, for some reasons that have never been explained, couldn't make outgoing calls. For some 30 minutes or more, which was a most important period of time, they had little or no information. Raymond T. Moore, the regional director of radiological health for the U.S. Public Health Service, wrote in a memo to his boss 2 days later. The authorities did address one issue quickly, the question of whether dangerous radiation had been released. Within hours of the blast, technicians had already gathered air, water, and soil samples and, they said, determined that no radiation above normal background levels was detected. Further analysis by a Public Health Service radiological lab confirmed that no significant contamination had been released. Well, how is that possible? The explanation is that the explosion was not, strictly speaking, a nuclear blast. Because the radioactive fissile core of each sphere had already been removed, all that was left, other than the TNT-based explosives, were the natural uranium and the depleted uranium, neither of which was dangerously radioactive. The TNT itself was enough to cause a massive explosion, but not the nuclear nightmare that so many feared. Yet, as the years have gone by and Americans have become more skeptical of what their government tells them, some of the people who grew up at Lackland have wondered if they've gotten the full story about the after effects of the explosion. Children of Lackland Elementary School dispersed as their Air Force parents were transferred or deployed, and they eventually left their homes in San Antonio and went their own ways. but many of them remain such good friends that they have occasional reunions. The most recent one was held last year in San Antonio. In the spacious lobby of the historic Menger Hotel, a stone's throw from the Alamo, 10 Lackland alumni, a few of their spouses, and one of their teachers gathered over scrapbooks and old issues of the Junior Tailspinner, the school's newspaper. They shared prosaic memories. The 4-foot rattlesnake one of the kids brought home from the woods around Site King, the secret preteen crushes, and the awkward dances at the youth center. Oddly, most of the former Lackland kids and attendants whom I talked with said that the explosion hadn't had a significant effect on their lives. When pushed, they spoke of the various traumas of the 60s, the assassinations, the race riots, the friends and family lost in Vietnam, and said that they regard that day's events as inseparable from those larger forces. The explosion was just another event in a decade that left them and much of the country reeling. As they reminisced about their years at Lackland, they also mentioned, sadly, as people their age do, those who are gone. At least 5 close classmates have died, 2 from brain tumors, 2 in their early 60s from other cancers, and 1 from a heart attack. 2 other classmates currently have cancer. Inevitably, the people gathered there wondered if the explosion of Igloo 572 had something to do with these deaths and illnesses. When we started to see all these people with cancer, we started wondering if there wasn't some connection, said Jane Vaughn, now 66, who was 9 at the time of the explosion. Over the past year, I've worked to get an answer to that question. One problem, it's hard to know if the number of Lackland alums with cancer is unusual. Military families frequently move around, so it's difficult to track down every student who would have been there at the time. I've managed to contact 50 of the likely hundreds of children who passed through Lackland Elementary School during the early 60s. Hardly enough to do a proper epidemiological study. I've dug up reams of technical reports on the explosion and its aftermath, including the original files of the Atomic Energy Commission and analyses of the air, water, and soil sampling done immediately after the explosion and in the days and years afterward. At Lackland in 2002, 2009, and 2010, the Air Force commissioned studies of possible radiological contamination of the soil at the site. Each of the studies found that any contamination was below safe limits. Last summer, I forwarded all of that material to Sheldon Landsberger, a professor of nuclear and radiation engineering at the University of Texas at Austin, who serves on the board of the Journal of Environmental Radioactivity. Landsberger didn't see any evidence of contamination at Lackland dangerous enough to cause cancer. There's no smoking gun, he told me. It's hard to predict that cancer would come from this explosion. Still, even if there was no epidemiological significance to the explosion, the violent destruction of a nuclear weapons bunker in a major city is a sort of historical event that one would think would live on in Texans' memories decades later. And yet, the Lackland explosion has been forgotten by almost everyone but those who experienced it. Perhaps that's because the story, in the end, is somewhat anticlimactic. It was a seemingly worst-case scenario that turned out to be not that bad after all. It started with a bang and ended with a whimper. Or perhaps the Lackland explosion has been lost to history because it was soon overshadowed by a much more momentous event. On November 21st, 8 days after the blast, Air Force One landed at San Antonio International Airport, and President John F. Kennedy and First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy descended to be greeted by a delirious public. Crowds of people wearing their Sunday best leaned out of windows and balconies and waved and cheered as the motorcade sped the President, First Lady, and Texas Governor John Connally and his wife Nellie through downtown and out to Brooks Air Force Base to dedicate a new aerospace medical facility. The Lackland Elementary School kids were bussed over to hear the president speak, and afterward, Claudia Petrosky and her friend Sally Walter McLaughlin unexpectedly ran into JFK and Jackie waiting at their car. Petrosky remembers Jackie, who must have realized that they had been part of the audience, saying, "Oh, Jack, look, the children." Jackie and the president shook hands with them. "She had her white gloves on," Petrosky said. "I idolized her." Later that day, the Kennedys flew to Houston, and then on to Fort Worth, where they stayed overnight. The next morning, November 22nd, they boarded Air Force One once again and took off for Dallas. And we turn next to another of our feature articles for this issue. This is entitled Unfriendly Skies. With its industry reeling, Fort Worth-based American Airlines is quietly betting that diminished competition will keep passengers coming, even as they grumble about the carrier's poor service, late arrivals, and jam-packing of its flights amid the pandemic. It's by Jason Hyde. United States Senator Jeff Merkley, an Oregon Democrat, wasn't happy when he boarded an American Airlines flight from DFW to Portland in early July. The day before, the airline had adjusted its COVID-19 safety policies and resumed selling every available seat rather than leaving most middle seats empty, as it had been doing since the onset of the pandemic. Merkley took to Twitter to voice his displeasure. At American Air, how many Americans will die because you fill middle seats with while your customers shoulder to shoulder, hour after hour? He wrote above a selfie showing the cabin nearly full of passengers behind him. This is incredibly irresponsible. People eat and drink on planes and must take off masks to do so. No way you aren't facilitating spread of COVID infections. Twitter masses piled on. The greed of American Air is breathtaking. After being bailed out by our taxes, they're stuffing people in like sardines to make more money. I have had a deep, visceral loathing for American Airlines for a very long time. They've always been the worst airline I've ever traveled on. And this from model and activist Chrissy Teigen, soon amplified by her more than 13 million followers. Not to be dramatic, but American Airlines only cares about money and doesn't care if you get sick and die. Despite that, another backlash, which included the head of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention testifying to substantial disappointment with American Airlines. At a Senate hearing that same week, the company continued to fill every seat it could on its sharply reduced schedule of flights. To many observers, it seemed the ultimate example of a theme among many major airlines over the past two decades, squeezing customers for every penny while turning to the government for a handout in an economic downturn. The litany of offenses is familiar. Bag fees, pioneered by American, change fees, fees for the privilege of selecting your smaller and smaller seat. All of these and more have left many travelers feeling extorted. Fort Worth-based American has been at the forefront of many of the charges of the changes. As longtime transportation analyst Seth Kaplan says, American has tried harder to really push the envelope. It doesn't help that the airline has also developed a reputation for poor service. In 2019, well before COVID-19 struck, American's on-time rate ranked among the worst in the industry, and it canceled more of its flights than any other domestic carrier. Meanwhile, starting in 2014, the company had been booking record profits, more than $7.6 billion in 2015. But rather than save that money for a rainy day, American gave its shareholders and executives handsome payouts thanks to aggressive stock buybacks. At the same time, it racked up billions in debt to pay for hundreds of new planes. Then came the coronavirus. By the time of Merkley's tweet, the airline had accepted nearly $6 billion in federal pandemic bailout money and would soon plead for more to prevent mass layoffs. American executives dismiss any suggestion that they have acted irresponsibly about money or passenger safety. They'd stockpiled more than $7 billion in cash by the beginning of 2020 and figured that was enough to weather a downturn, just not one anywhere near as severe as what happened. They dispute claims that they've compromised the health of passengers and defend the decision to pack pandemic-era planes by emphasizing the cleaning regimen between flights and the hospital-grade filtration system that entirely replaces the plane's cabin's air every few minutes. They argue that the airline was responding to what customers wanted in the same way that all those hated fees let it offer lower fares. Selling middle seats to willing flyers during a time of social distancing, in other words, is smart business, even if it whips up an angry Twitter mob. What remains to be seen is whether American has finally gone too far, whether cold, short-term calculations about what the market will bear during a pandemic will have a lingering effect on travelers' willingness to book American when air travel returns to normal. Overnight, you can become that thug carrier, warns Dennis Tazier, a 28-year veteran of American Airlines pilot and a spokesman for its pilots' union. When you know that there's more seats filled and then the service is not reliable and people don't seem happy, it all gets balled up into you're not humanizing air travel, you're dehumanizing it. How has American survived its poor reputation among flyers, and why is it acting as if it can continue to do so? One answer is that consumers face extremely limited choices when it comes to flying. At some small airports, there's no choice among airlines at all. In Texas, the major airlines practically monopolize several of the largest airports. American accounts for more than 80% of the traffic at DFW, United for about 77% at Houston's George Bush Intercontinental. Southwest carries more than 90% of the passengers at both Dallas Love Field and Houston Hobby. Combined, those three airlines have carved out about 70% of the commercial air traffic in the state. That gives individual customers relatively little power to prevent airlines from making unpopular but lucrative decisions. I don't want it to be depressing, but if you're in an oligopolistic business, that's exactly what happens, says Rice University Associate Business Professor Anastasia Zayavalova, who studies corporate reputation management. So, what's the effect of being the UGG carrier in the midst of the worst crisis the industry has ever faced? Maybe not at all. Maybe American knows exactly what it's doing. We have a kind of natural spot here to break real quick and remind you that you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight Into Town Broadcasting. Here marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight Into Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight Into Sound Radio since 1967. Now, back to our text. This is the feature article, Unfriendly Skies. Winding its way to the global headquarters of United Airlines, Skyview Drive passes carefully landscaped patches of drought-resistant grasses, trees, and cacti just south of DFW Airport. One sunny 90-degree morning in August, thousands of parking spaces sit empty in the garage across from the gleaming new office building, Skyview 8. Opened last fall as part of a $350 million project to expand the corporate campus, the building now looks like a monument to the optimism that pervaded the airline industry prior to the pandemic. Inside, a three-story high ceiling over the circular lobby resembles a giant jet turbine. Above the cafeteria hangs a long, twisting white sculpture built from fan blades by employees at the airline's Tulsa Maintenance Center. The piece, Tulsa Verter, is meant to evoke the swirling vortices of air that trail off the wingtips of a plane in flight. Though the building was designed to accommodate almost 6,000 workers, on this day only about 500 are working on site. Chairman and CEO Doug Parker, who just a week before joined other airline executives in Washington to lobby Congress for another round of federal bailout funds, eases back into his chair in a glass-walled conference room overlooking the atrium. "It's a full-blown crisis," he says, "of the industry's recent collapse. I don't think about much else." Parker, who was CEO of Tempe, Arizona-based American West Airlines on September 11, 2001, has seen his share of ups and downs in the industry. Came up as a numbers guy, first as a financial planner at American in the 80s, then as a vice president at Northwest, now Delta, then CFO, and finally CEO at American West. It was a famously volatile period in the industry as old airlines went out of business or consolidated with new ones, and new ones emerged following federal deregulations in 1978. Parker was 10 days into a CEO job at American West on 9/11, and if it weren't for the government loan he ended up securing, the airline would have gone out of business. That he positioned the business to be acquired by U.S. Airways 4 years later and landed himself in the CEO role of that larger company. 8 years after that, in 2013, he pulled off the same trick when American and U.S. Airways merged, this time landing himself in one of the most powerful positions in the airline game anywhere in the world. By then, all the consolidation had reduced competition to the point that just four airlines, United, Delta, American, and Southwest, accounted for more than 80% of the commercial air travel in the United States. Diminished competition resulted in higher prices and, for most carriers, worse customer service, but it also ensured more reliable profits for each of the big four. And for years, there was no louder cheerleader for the idea that the industry had finally sorted itself out than Parker. He wasn't shy about publicly professing that his company would never lose money again, even in an economic downturn. "We'll have good years and bad years, but we won't have disasters," he said during a panel session at one industry conference in 2017. "We won't go through the kinds of ebbs and flows we've had in the past. Certainly, we'll still be cyclical, but the downtimes are going to be a lot better." That attitude, along with billions in annual profits buoyed by low fuel prices, does much to explain Americans' decision to pursue billions in spending while piling up vast debts in recent years. Parker's bet was that, if his read on the industry's stability was right, Americans' steady profits would remain plentiful enough to keep its planes flying, keep its creditors happy, and keep billions in cash on hand in case of emergency. Only the good times didn't keep rolling, and the magnitude of the bad times that arrived with COVID-19 was unprecedented. All the airlines saw their business collapse this year. In the first week of April, at the height of the pandemic lockdowns, American had twice as many cancellations as new tickets sold. Early on during the pandemic, the airline was losing about $70 million each day. By summer, it managed to reduce that number to $30 million daily. Slashing the flight schedule, retiring some planes, and laying off 30% of its corporate management and support staff was a start. Skyview 7, a 90,000-square-foot IT support building that sits across a creek from Skyview 8 and opened at the same time, was shuttered, and its remaining staffers were reassigned to offices elsewhere. Construction was also halted on Skyview 6, a planned $250 million hotel complex intended to house American workers in town for training sessions. The building's unfinished steel frame quietly towers in full view from Skyview 8's central atrium and Parker's desk, a fitting symbol of the uncertainty into which a global pandemic unceremoniously thrust the airline industry. Traveling the skies used to be glamorous and adventurous. An American still likes to trade on its roots in early days aviation. According to the company's official history, the first American Airlines flight took place on April 15, 1926, when a pilot named Charles Lindbergh carried a plane load of mail from St. Louis to Chicago. A little more than a year later, Lindbergh achieved worldwide fame when he successfully made the first solo nonstop transatlantic flight. Yet the actual birth of American Airlines has more to do with numbers-driven mergers and acquisitions than feats of daring do. Central figure of the company's inception isn't a hotshot young pilot. It's an accountant named C.R. Smith, a Texan who rose from the rank and file of a small Fort Worth airline, Texas Air Transport. It was just one of more than 80 small companies that eventually merged to become American. Smith was tapped as president of the new airline in 1934 and led its transformation from carrying mail to serving passengers. In his 34 years as president of the business, he also introduced the first airline lounge system, the Admiral's Club, and a computerized passenger reservation system, Sabre, developed with IBM. It wasn't until 1979 that Dallas-Fort Worth leaders convinced American to relocate to North Texas. It had been based in New York since 1939 by building it a headquarters south of DFW Airport, which had opened just 5 years earlier. Lower rent and other operational costs in Texas, as well as DFW's more central location within the country, made the move a smart decision for American. It was a boon for Texas. It led to other major corporate relocations and helped the state become a global business hub. After mostly thriving during the 80s and 90s, American bought up TWA right before 9/11 and ended up shuffling through the aughts, finally being forced into bankruptcy in 2011, a victim of the Great Recession. That's when Doug Parker managed to swoop in and orchestrate his $11 billion merger with U.S. Airways. It was the last of the major airline consolidations and turned American into the world's largest passenger carrier. By all accounts, Parker sought to bring a more transparent culture to American's business than had existed before, for example, by regularly hosting town hall sessions with employees. He's fond of parroting legendary Southwest Airlines founder Herb Kelleher's management philosophy, that holding that if the company takes care of its employees will take care of the customers. He's also emulated Kelleher's fondness for dressing up in outrageous Halloween costumes. Last year, Parker was Billy Ray Cyrus as he and other executives performed Old Town Road for employees at the corporate headquarters. Another year, he was a tambourine-toting Boy George jamming to Karma Chameleon. Perhaps it's not surprising that Parker's efforts to build a fun and open culture around the workplace have never quite trickled down to customers. After all, when U.S. Airways was under his watch, that airline tried charging for soft drinks, water, coffee, and tea in the midst of the Great Recession. Parker reversed course when other airlines failed to follow his lead and customers complained about the nickel and diming. Of course, Parker has hardly been the only airline leader squeezing passengers over the past decade. Both Delta and United have reduced the cushioning of their coach seats and the space between rows in recent years, but American outdid them both in 2017 when it announced the seating arrangements on its new Boeing 737 MAX jets. Standard distance between seat backs in the economy section was to be 30 inches. A one-inch reduction, and several rows would be just 29 inches apart. American argued that its slimmer, red, less padded seats would make the difference negligible, but the company quickly reversed course on the 29-inch plan over housing protests from customers and some employees. Likewise, the myriad additional fees travelers encounter nowadays when booking were not solely American's invention. Brian Buell, an associate professor at Harvard Business School who studies customer experience, points to the rise of online booking sites as a key driver of those changes. As search results increasingly showed customers ultra-low fares from budget carriers such as Spirit and Frontier, the legacy airlines needed to compete. They reduced the services and amenities that previously came along with a standard ticket and offered restrictive basic economy rates. From a cynical perspective, it looked like the airlines were simply boosting their bottom lines. We become accustomed to what we think we should get from the airline, and the airline has basically moved the goalposts, Buell says. But the success of the low-cost carriers showed clear demand for no-frills flights and tolerance for fees, and that meant the mainstream carriers had to do something to remain competitive on price. The decision to stop blocking middle seats as of July 1st was a similarly straightforward case of meeting customer demand, American executives claim. With the partial reopening of the businesses across much of the Sun Belt in May and June, more flyers were showing up than anyone had expected. As many as 20% of Americans' flights were hitting maximum capacity on some days. We believe that we need to get people to where they need to go, and that's an obligation, says Chief Customer Officer Allison Taylor. They could have accomplished that goal, of course, by adding flights and continuing to block middle seats, but that would have cost more than simply jamming additional travelers onto each flight. American executives argue that blocking middle seats does little to prevent the spread of disease. For one thing, social distancing isn't really possible when flying commercial, given that even window and aisle seats aren't 6 feet apart. In July, an MIT statistics professor estimated that the odds of a passenger contracting the novel coronavirus on a flight between Dallas and New York City, on which every seat was full and everyone wore a mask, was 1 in 4,300. Not zero, but also not necessarily scary. Still, that same professor found that those odds looked much better, just 1 in 7,700, if the middle seats were empty. In other words, by blocking a third of the seats on a plane and foregoing the associated revenue or raising prices, airlines could cut the odds of infection by nearly half. To the outraged folks on Twitter, American was saying that there was a limit to how much it valued their health. Back in May and June, about 15 miles east of American's Fort Worth headquarters, executives at the other major airline based in Texas, Southwest, sat in their Dallas headquarters next to Love Field, tracking the same uptick in passenger demand. They came to an entirely different decision. Instead of unlocking middle seats to get more passengers to where they needed to go, Southwest added flights to its pandemic-reduced schedule, despite the additional costs involved. We could have put those passengers on empty seats on flights that we were already taking, and that would have been a better short-term business decision, says Southwest CEO Gary Kelly. But because we're trying to reassure our customers and make sure that they have a good flight experience, something that they're comfortable with so they'll come back, we felt that that was the right decision. Americans and Southwest's starkly different approaches to navigating the pandemic express two starkly different philosophies. Southwest enjoys a customer-friendly brand reputation that's the envy of many businesses well beyond the airline industry. It entered the pandemic with relatively little debt compared to American and could boast of 47 straight years of annual profitability, a streak that will end in 2020, in an industry in which every other major carrier that has existed as far back as the 80s has either dissolved or gone through bankruptcy. Southwest has famously declined to charge customers to check bags or to tack on any fee beyond the price difference for changing tickets. It heavily advertises how different these policies are from those of the other big airlines. Its leaders believe that by eschewing these hidden fees of flying, Southwest wins greater customer loyalty. It typically ranks at or near the top of influential customer satisfaction ratings among all airlines, well ahead of American. What's remarkable, says Rice's Zayavalova, is that Southwest bothers with any of its customer-friendly measures. When all of your competitors are raking in billions in bag fees and change fees, why not join in? This option has been regularly discussed at Southwest board meetings and regularly rejected. The reason, she surmises, stems from Southwest's 1967 founding, when it was set up by Herb Kelleher and co-founder Roland King from the beginning to upend industry norms with its flatter, more democratic approach. There have been studies that look at the imprinting effect of founders of companies, Zayavalova says. Whatever values they instill early on at the company's inception tend to trickle down for decades. Harvard's Buell describes that values system as principles-based, one that allows employees flexibility in making decisions as long as they follow general principles, beginning with Kelleher's insistence from day one that it be the low-fare airline. If a situation arises in which strictly following procedures would result in a customer's experience not aligning with the principle, an employee would feel more empowered to make an exception to exercise her judgment in the long-term interest of the company. By contrast, American and the other legacy carriers are rules-based organizations that heavily prescribe procedures from which workers are expected not to deviate. That's not to say that Southwest doesn't have rules, Buell says. It's just that the employees aren't as empowered on those other airlines to take license to try and create a better service experience. Doug Parker says it's unfair to contrast American's policies with Southwest's. American's business is far more complex, he says. Pre-pandemic, American flew to 350 destinations in 50 countries with a fleet of more than 1,500 planes of 17 types. Southwest flies to just 103 destinations, none beyond North America and the Caribbean. Its fleet numbers about 750 planes and are all Boeing 737s, an approach that makes training and maintenance much more efficient. Like the other legacy carriers, American routes most of its flights through major hubs, whereas Southwest operates a point-to-point system that offers more direct flights and reduces the effect on the entire network when a particular hub experiences delays. American chases premium customers with first-class seats and lounges, as well as those looking for a deal through those stripped-down basic economy fares. Meanwhile, the cabins on Southwest planes are egalitarian spaces, the same type of seat no matter how much you paid. The only extra it sells is the right to board the plane earlier than others. Is Southwest aimed to serve as broad a customer base to as many destinations as the legacy carriers, Parker claims, then it too would have to add bag fees and change fees, perhaps losing some of its customer-friendly reputation in the process. I can't say enough good things about Southwest, he says, but we have very different products. When it comes to blocking middle seats in the interest of social distancing, the differing decisions of Southwest and American might be explained by their levels of pre-pandemic debt and not just their concerns for customers' health risks. It's surely more than a coincidence that of the four biggest U.S. carriers, the two that entered 2020 in the strongest financial position, Delta and Southwest, continued to limit their seat count into the fall, while United and American didn't. Coming into this year, Parker needed to win. Despite the streak of profitable years and the borrowing frenzy fueled by low interest rates, the summer of 2019 was an operational disaster for American, with its mechanics union organizing a work slowdown that helped sink its on-time flight performance to dismal levels. At the same time, the company's stock price had been on a steady decline, falling more than 50% between January 2018 and October 2019, mainly because of concerns about all that debt. In the words of airline industry analyst Helene Becker from the investment bank Cowen, there's a fair amount of frustration among investors that American didn't do enough during the good times to set up for the bad times. Dennis Tager from the pilots union points to the stock buybacks as the biggest issue. You're buying bottles of champagne when really you should have probably been paying down your credit card debt, he says. This company is not realistic. It's not even smart. Rumors swirled last fall that Parker wasn't long for his job and that his former deputy, Scott Kirby, who was fired in 2016 and now runs United, would return. A year later, the talk has subsided. Though Parker would never choose to be in this situation, in an unexpected way, the pandemic has offered a bit of a fresh start. If some of American's operational hiccups in recent years can be chalked up to lingering inefficiencies from the merger, well, the pandemic has forced American to become a leaner business and maybe slightly more forgiving one. At the end of August, United Airlines announced it was eliminating change fees permanently for most tickets. The next day, Delta and American did the same. Though years of recovery will be required before American or any of the major airlines is flying anywhere near as much as it did in 2019, analysts don't expect to see the company going under. No one's complaining about the billions in additional debt that the airline has taken on this year either. All of its competitors are doing likewise. They've all got to do whatever they can to survive until most travelers feel safe on planes again. As August gave way to September, the likelihood increased that Congress would do nothing more for the airline industry. American informed its unions that, as of October 1st, 40,000 fewer people would be working for the company than before the pandemic. United and Delta announced thousands of impending layoffs of their own. The exception among the country's four biggest carriers, once again, was Southwest. Unlike its competitors at Southwest, enough employees had accepted generous voluntary buyout offers that there would be no layoffs, at least not in 2020. Coming weeks and months will be some of the most difficult we've ever faced, Parker and Company President Robert Isom wrote to employees a week after my visit to the airline's headquarters. It was a grim note at a time when thousands of people would lose their livelihood, but the executives added a note of confidence or possibly defiance. The world will find its new normal, they wrote, and when it does, American is going to be there. We next turn back to our state section for news and politics. This is Medicine. This article also by Jason Hyde, just like the last article we read. For rural Texans, a virtual doc in a box. Can new technologies fill healthcare gaps left by dozens of small-town hospital closures? Texas A&M aims to find out. The 9-foot-tall kiosk tucked into a corner of the sheriff's office in small town of Cameron looks something like a super-sized photo booth. 11 feet long, more than 7 feet wide, bulky structure, essentially a robotic doctor's office, was built to address a crisis that Milam County has faced since its only two hospitals abruptly closed 2 years ago. If locals embrace the kiosk, others like it could be deployed throughout rural Texas, where many communities have similarly lost critical access to health care over the past decade. Joyce Daly, a 78-year-old resident of Rockdale, midway between Austin and College Station, was one of the first to try out the telehealth station not long after it was installed in July. Daly worried that her lack of technological savvy would prove an impediment, but was surprised at how easy it was to use the kiosk. Built by a Tampa-based company, OnMed, the telehealth station is remotely operated by clinicians in that Florida city more than 1,000 miles away. A thermal camera reads the patient's body heat to detect fever, a scale, a stethoscope, a blood pressure cuff, and a pulse oximeter to measure oxygen in the blood, assess vital signs. An automated dispensary built into the kiosk stocks common prescription and over-the-counter medications. After each patient visit, ultraviolet light sanitizes the booth's interior. All Dally had to do was to connect via video conferencing with a nurse practitioner at OnMed's headquarters was tap the word start on a large touchscreen. Clinician used the booth's instruments to measure Dally's height, weight, and blood pressure, and they discussed her history of hypertension. Dally learned that the dispensary could provide the blood pressure medication her regular doctor prescribes should she ever urgently need some. I was laughing so hard just because it's such a new thing, Dally says. Kiosk in Cameron is only the second on-med telehealth station anywhere, and it's the first in a rural setting. It arrived in Milam County thanks to Texas A&M University's Rural and Community Health Institute, known as ARCHI, A-R-C-H-I, which will spend 2 years studying how well its telemedicine serves the unmet needs of an area lacking medical care outside the regular business hours of a few primary care clinics. When their needs are greatest, residents of the county often must drive as long as an hour to Temple, Round Rock, or College Station to reach an open urgent care center or emergency room. Rural communities throughout the state face similar challenges. According to the Texas Organization of Rural and Community Hospitals, 26 rural hospitals in Texas have closed since 2010. 35 of the state's 254 counties have no practicing physicians, and many more lack specialists. The crisis led Blue Cross Blue Shield of Texas, largest health insurer in the state, to grant $10 million to A&M in 2018 to pursue moonshot solutions. The effort aims to be an Apollo program for rural health care, and a roughly $200,000 on-med station is one of the first of its experiments to get underway. We're not looking to take what we currently do and move it a quarter of an inch. We've been doing that for years, says Nancy W. Dickey, Executive Director of ARCHI. Are there some things that are a little bit on the Buck Rogers side that are potentially doable today that we simply haven't attempted? Texas is hardly alone in seeing rural hospitals shut down. Nationwide, 120 have closed since 2010, and hundreds more are considered at risk, a situation worsened by the financial strains of the COVID-19 pandemic. Many of the medical breakthroughs that have allowed Americans to live longer, healthier lives have also driven up the cost of health care, making it increasingly difficult for small-town medical centers to stay in business. Often these hospitals can't afford the most advanced equipment or attract specialists reluctant to work outside better-paying cities. Trickier still, as young Americans have fled rural areas for urban ones, those remain tend to be older and have greater health care needs. Small-town Texans are more likely to have chronic conditions than city dwellers and are less likely to be able to pay for care. Several other factors exacerbate Texas's rural health care challenges. Because the state is so large, the distances between underserved communities and the nearest urban centers with available care can be vast. We're talking about lots of space and lots of people, Dickey says. Doesn't help that Texas also has by far the most uninsured residents of any state. In terms of both raw numbers, more than 5 million as of 2018, and percentage of the population, 17.7%. Those uninsured Texans are disproportionately concentrated in rural areas. To better understand the scope of the problem, A&M researchers are collecting data on the health effects of rural hospital closures in Texas. A recent California study found an 8.7% increase in mortality in such communities that had lost a hospital. Their findings are expected by the end of the year. Of A&M's other various small-town healthcare projects in development, the furthest along is a phone app, kind of an Uber, says Dickey, that allows 911 dispatchers to summon volunteer emergency responders in Milam County, which is served by only 3 ambulances for its roughly 25,000 residents and 1,017 square miles. Hour-plus drives to the nearest ER mean each of these ambulances is unavailable for at least 2 hours each time it answers a call. Ward Rodham, a Rockdale native and the chief of the town's volunteer fire department, has seen the devastating effects firsthand. We, as a fire department, have found ourselves doing CPR for 45 minutes, waiting for an ambulance to come out of another county, Rodham says. We worked on cardiac patients that have died on the scene after we've done everything that we could. Researchers have started recruiting volunteer responders for the app, though much of the basic training they need, such as CPR, will have to take place virtually because of pandemic restrictions. The coronavirus is complicating several of the A&M projects. One is a new mobile app designed to help Texans manage chronic conditions such as diabetes. Because of the virus, enrollment efforts to test the app in rural areas of the Rio Grande Valley have been hindered. A&M can't host recruitment meetings there as it had planned. Similar delays have plagued an effort to organize a network of independent hospitals in several counties between Amarillo and Abilene that might benefit from merging some administrative offices or by sharing specialists. Dickey remains hopeful that the delays won't prevent the project from yielding results that can be replicated elsewhere in the state and the nation. ARCHI has agreements to advise more than 100 hospitals across the United States, thanks in part to a $4 million federal grant it won in 2018. Yet some factors affecting rural health care are well beyond A&M's power to change. Greater access to broadband internet service, for instance, would improve telehealth options. expansion of Medicaid funding and eligibility, especially stingy in Texas, would get more low-income residents to the care they need. So would an overhaul of medical education to encourage more physicians, particularly specialists, to practice outside metropolitan areas. Some of these are not things that small towns can deal with on their own, Dickey says. She's lobbying federal and state lawmakers to pay attention. Meanwhile, Milam County would get to keep its on-med telehealth station for at least 2 years. After 3 months of demonstrations, during which some 400 locals tried it out, the kiosk opened for public use in October, was placed inside the sheriff's office because that's the one facility in town open 24 hours a day. Researchers hope the on-med station will eventually be open all night, though they're starting with more limited hours. Patients with or without insurance are charged $65 per consultation, a relatively low cost made possible by the reduced overhead of the station as compared with a typical doctor's office. A visit to a typical urgent care clinic or emergency room for even a minor ailment might run hundreds or thousands of dollars. Joy Alonzo, an A&M professor and the lead researcher on the two moonshot projects in Milam County, is hoping to place between 5 and 10 more on-med stations elsewhere in rural Texas. Her first target is Brewster County in the Big Bend region, which has almost no doctors for its 9,000 or so residents. Alonzo exudes confidence in the technology's potential. 20 years from now, you won't think anything of jumping into something like this if you need a same-day appointment, she says. It will be something everybody does as opposed to something that no one's ever seen before. What remains to be seen is how well the people of Milam County will embrace that technology. As in many rural spots, the population skews older than in the state as a whole. Dally worries that older residents will be intimidated by the on-med station, as she initially was. Whether enough of them give it a chance could determine whether the county government takes over funding its operation once A&M's research is complete. Dally notes that a telehealth booth is hardly a full substitute for the care Milam County lost when its hospitals closed. The doctors and nurses who treated locals there were also their friends and neighbors, fellow churchgoers and club members. A clinician to me, if they truly care, they have our trust, she says. We give them our vital secrets. We establish relationships with those people. That, to me, is a part of what that rural healthcare is about. Still, Dally is promoting the kiosk to her neighbors. She doesn't want to risk losing another form of care, robotic or not. I think rather than have a closed mind, let's see what we have. That brings up.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30. As we celebrate Thanksgiving, Recording Library of West Texas Radio is bringing you a special selection of iconic audio-described movies. Tonight at 6:30, it's Tom Hanks in Forrest Gump. And we conclude our weekend of classic films tomorrow morning at 8 when Gene Kelly stars in Singin' in the Rain. We hope you enjoy our audio-described iconic movies all weekend from Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, Yuletide carols being sung by a choir, and folks dressed up like Eskimos. Everybody knows a turkey and some mistletoe help to make the season bright. Tiny tots with their eyes all aglow will find it hard to sleep tonight. They know that Santa's on his way. He's loaded lots of toys and goodies on his sleigh. And every mother's child is gonna spy to see if reindeer really know how to fly. And so I'm offering this simple phrase to kids from 1 to 92. Although it's been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas to you. Simple phrase to kids from 1 to 92. Although it's been said many times, many ways, Merry Christmas to you.
Jingle bells swing and jingle bells ring, snowing and blowing up bushels of fun. Now the jingle hop has begun. Jingle bell, jingle bell, jingle bell rock. Jingle bells chime and jingle bell time, dancing and prancing in Jingle Bell Square. In the frosty air, what a bright time, it's the right time to rock the night away. Jingle bell time is a swell time to go gliding in the one horse sleigh. Giddy up, jingle horse, pick up your feet, jingle around the clock. Mix and mingle in the jingling feet, that's the jingle bell rock.
Jingle bell, jingle bell, jingle bell rock. Jingle bell chime and jingle bell time, dancing and prancing in Jingle Bell Square. In the frosty air,
what a bright time, it's the right time to rock the night away. Go gliding in the one horse sleigh. Giddy up, jingle horse, pick up your feet, jingle around the clock. Mix and a mingle in the jingling feet, that's the jingle bell, that's the jingle bell, that's the jingle bell rock.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 52 and partly cloudy. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 30s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 50s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 30s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McLamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight into Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the November issue of Texas Highways, and I'll start out with the article, All Kinds of Colors, Dancing Everywhere, Lauren Anderson, who broke ground as a black ballerina in Houston, reflects on a career of movement, by Sabrina LaBeouf. For ballet fans, the arrival of fall means nutcracker season. It's a tradition Lauren Anderson holds dear. The retired Houston dancer has performed nearly every role in Tchaikovsky's enduring work, going back to 1972, when she was one of Mother Ginger's children in the Houston Ballet's first-ever production of the holiday classic. Upon joining the company in 1983, she played the lead role of Sugar Plum Fairy. Anderson's experience paid off when, in 1990, the Houston Ballet promoted her to principal dancer, making her the first African-American to hold the position in the company. Over the next 15 years, working with renowned choreographer Ben Stevenson, Anderson danced her way through the Firebird, Swan Lake, Don Quixote, and countless other works. After retiring in 2006, Anderson stayed with the Houston Ballet as the company's program manager of education and community engagement, providing dance instruction at disadvantaged schools. While Anderson now focuses on teaching academic and life skills through the arts and raising a son of her own, she has been recognized for accomplishments in the dance world. In 2016, the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C., honored Anderson's career by enshrining her ballet shoes in its permanent exhibit. A year later, she received the Texas Medal of Arts Award in Dance. Though COVID-19 forced the Houston Ballet to cancel its annual performance of the Nutcracker, the season remains a time of reflection for Anderson. What are some of your early memories of the Nutcracker? The only time I wasn't nervous performing was my very first performance, which was the Nutcracker in 1972 at Jones Hall. I will never forget it. I didn't realize the magnitude of what I was doing until I got out there on stage. From then on, every time I perform, I'm nervous. That's just normal, right? I'll never forget seeing my first Sugar Plum Fairy. Standing there, I'm looking through a stairway that's part of a set for the party scene. I remember looking through the rungs of that stairway into the light at the Sugar Plum Fairy and wanting to be her. So, I got to retire as the Sugar Plum Fairy. There's a picture of a mother ginger child looking through the rungs of the stairway as I'm the Sugar Plum Fairy. I was just like, that was me 40 years ago. Why did you choose to join the Houston Ballet versus a company elsewhere? I'm a native Houstonian. I love Houston. People are still trying to get me to go run stuff in different cities. They're still trying, but there's just something about Houston. All that said, I didn't think I was going to get in the Houston Ballet. I thought I was going to have to go to Dance Theater of Harlem because that's where the African-American people, the people of color, were dancing. I did know that Houston was hiring black dancers because in 1976, Adrian Vincent James, who was the first African-American in the Houston Ballet, was in the company. So it's not like I didn't know, but I just thought that I would have to go somewhere else. And then in 83, when I auditioned, I got hired and I just never left. Growing up, what was it like to dance as a black ballerina? It wasn't a thing until it became a thing. When you become an adolescent, you realize you don't look like everybody else. You want to look like everybody. You want to be like everybody. You want to fit in. And I just kind of didn't. However, I was never treated that way at Houston Ballet, but I felt like I didn't fit in. I saw Dance Theater of Harlem when I was 9, and that's when I realized that I hadn't seen a black ballerina before. How does it feel to be included in the National Museum of African American History and Culture? It's an honor to be in a national museum. The museum starts with slavery and goes all the way up through successes, all kinds of achievements. Then you get to theater and music and dance. And like I said, I saw the Dance Theater of Harlem when I was 9, and I'm displayed in the same case as the Dance Theater of Harlem. I really think if I hadn't seen that company, I don't think I'd be dancing. So I'm really honored to be in that case. My story is there at the bottom with a picture of me as the Sugar Plum Fairy. I'm on the wall. I'm there as the Firebird, and my name is on a little plaque. It's just a little overwhelming still. My great-great-grandkids can go there and say, "That's my great-great-grandmother." How have you seen opportunities change for black dancers, especially with ballerinas like Misty Copeland and Michaela DePrince now in the spotlight? I think because of social media and television dance shows, more people are interested in dance. So the more people getting interested in dance, the more kinds of people you're going to have dancing. All that said, with Misty and Michaela being dancers at major companies, all of that was already going on. That was going on 25 years ago with me, 10 years before that with Deborah Austin, 20 years before that with Raven Wilkinson, 10 years before that with Janet Collins. We could just keep going back. The difference now is we have social media, and we can see it. And laws are different. People are different. Generations are different. People have more education. People aren't as ignorant on color and racism. Do we have a long way to go? Yes, absolutely. However, it's definitely better, and it's definitely different because there are so many dancers of color, not just black, of all kinds of colors, dancing everywhere. What's it like to work with school kids in the company's education program? Sometimes you have kinesthetic learners and tactile learners, so we get to figure out what they need and make it happen. We teach kids, through movement, about life, learning, themselves, setting goals, accomplishing goals, working their butts off without even knowing it, but realizing that hard work helps them achieve the goals they want. We're trying to teach the complete child, so we add social-emotional learning into dance. It's arts integration. How would you assess the health of the ballet scene across Texas? How does it compare to other states? We hold our own. I know we've got Ballet Houston, Houston Ballet. There are a few companies in San Antonio, so there's a lot of dance here. I feel the Houston Ballet, specifically, doesn't get the respect it deserves. We're one of the best companies in the world. I'm not saying it just because I'm there. I don't dance there anymore. I just think that the world thinks that Texas is bang, bang, shoot 'em up, that we ride horses, and there's tumbleweed blowing around. Now, granted, in parts of Texas, there is tumbleweed blowing around. It's the terrain. But we can definitely hold our own in any industry, especially artistically. What are some of the biggest changes you've seen in Houston over your lifetime? As a child, when I was in Houston Ballet's first Nutcracker back in 1972, I remember going downtown. I knew we were going to get to have pizza between shows. It was a big deal. There were two restaurants in the theater district, Bear Peretti's and Longhorn Cafe. Now, in that exact city block, there are, I don't know, 6, 7, 8, 9 restaurants. Then there's Midtown, the connection of downtown to the rest of Houston. The growth of the city is amazing. COVID-19 prompted the Houston Ballet to cancel its production of the Nutcracker this year, but you can connect with the company and support its programs, including the online Nutcracker Market, November 11th through December 11th, at houstonballet.org. And now just a reminder, you're listening to Traveling Texas on Sight Into Sound Radio. You can listen to Sight Into Sound on Channel HD4 on 88.7 KUHF, Channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or smartphone, as well as Amazon Alexa and Google Home devices. You can also listen at your convenience on our podcast page at sightintosound.org. We are Sight Into Sound Radio since 1967. And now continuing on with articles from the November issue of Texas Highways, Love Conquers All. After 20 years and nearly as many restaurants, Fort Worth chef Tim Love hasn't slowed down or sold out. By June Naylor. Tim and Emily Love opened a tiny steakhouse in Fort Worth's historic Stockyards district in June 2000. Before its official debut, they scraped together enough money to pay for their plumbing by selling beer at a street party. Today,